Side 10, The Difference Engine, by William Gibson and Bruce Sterling. Continuing on page 350. Do find me that telegram. At your earliest convenience, of course. Wakefield inclined his head, but only very slightly. Good fellow, Oliphant declared. He saluted the undersecretary with his furled umbrella and rose, to retrace his steps through QC's cubbies and the bowed and patient heads of Wakefield's clerks. Oliphant had made his professionally circuitous way to Dean Street from the Soho Tavern, where he had instructed Betteridge to deposit him. Now he entered a soot-streaked house, its door unlatched. Latching it carefully behind him, he climbed two flights of uncarpeted stairs. The chill air smelled of cooked cabbage and stale tobacco. He rapped twice at a door, then twice again. "Come in, come in, you'll let in the cold." The heavily bearded Mr. Hermann Krieger, late of the New York Volkstribune, appeared to be wearing every article of clothing he possessed, as though he had wagered that he could all at once don the entire contents of a ragman's barrow. He locked and chained the door behind Oliphant. Krieger had two rooms, the one with the view of the street being the drawing room, and behind it a bedroom. Everything broken and tattered, and in the greatest disorder. A large old-fashioned table, covered with waxcloth, stood in the middle of the drawing room. On it lay manuscripts, books, newspapers, a doll with a Dresden head, bits and pieces of a woman's sewing things, chipped teacups, dirty spoons, pens, knives, candlesticks, an inkpot, Dutch clay pipes, tobacco ash. "Sit, sit, please." More ursine than ever in his bundled attire, Krieger waved vaguely toward a chair with only three legs. Blinking through a haze of coal and tobacco smoke, Oliphant made out a chair that seemed whole, though Krieger's daughter had been playing kitchen on it. Choosing to risk a pair of trousers, Oliphant swept jammy crumbs aside and sat, facing Krieger across the sad domestic litter of the crowded tabletop. "A small gift for your little Traudor," Oliphant said, taking a tissue-wrapped parcel from his coat. The tissue was secured with a self-adhesive rectangle, embossed with the initials of an Oxford Street toy emporium. "A doll's tea things." He placed the parcel on the table. "She calls you Uncle Larry. She shouldn't know your name." "Many is the Larry about Soho, I should imagine." Oliphant produced a plain envelope, unsealed, and placed it beside the parcel, precisely aligned with the table's edge. It contained three well-circulated five-pound notes. Krieger said nothing. A silence lengthened. "The Manhattan Women's Red Pantomime Troupe," Oliphant said at last. Krieger snorted derisively. "The Bowery's Sapphic Best come to London. I remember them in Purdy's National. They wooed and won the dead rabbits to the cause, whose sole previous involvement with politics had consisted of rock fights and punch-ups in municipal elections. The butcher boys, the bootblacks, the prostitutes of Chatham Square and the Five Points, that was their audience. Sweaty proletarians, come to see a woman shot out of a gun, flattened against a wall and peeled off like paper. I tell you, sir, your interest is misplaced." Oliphant sighed. "My friend, it is my job to ask questions. You must understand that I cannot tell you my reasons for asking a given question. I know that you have suffered. I know that you suffer now, in exile." Oliphant glanced meaningfully about the tragic room. "What, then, do you wish to know?" "It has been suggested that among the various criminal elements active during the recent civil disruptions were agents of Manhattan." Oliphant waited. "I find that unlikely."
"On what basis, Mr. Krieger?"
"To my knowledge, the Commune has no interest in disturbing the British status quo. Your Rads have shown themselves to be benevolent bystanders with regard to America's class struggle. Indeed, your nation has behaved as an ally of sorts." There was much bitterness in Krieger's tone, a curdled cynicism.
One imagines it was in Britain's own interest to see the Northern Union lose its greatest city to the communards.
Oliphant shifted cautiously on the uncomfortable chair. You knew Mr. Marx intimately, I believe. In order to extract a given piece of information from Krieger, he knew, it was necessary to engage the man's dominant passion. Knew him. I was there to greet him off the boat. He embraced me, and not a minute later had borrowed 20 gold dollars to pay his rent in the Bronx. Krieger essayed a sort of laugh, strangled with abiding rage. He'd his Jenny with him then, though the marriage didn't survive the revolution. But he'd a Brooklyn Irish factory girl in his bed when he expelled me from the commune, sir, for preaching religionism and free love. Free love, indeed. Krieger's large pale hands, with their unkept nails, plucked abstractedly at a sheaf of papers. You have been badly used, Mr. Krieger. Oliphant thought of his friend, Lord Engels. It did seem extraordinary that the brilliant textile manufacturer should involve himself, however distantly, with people of this sort. Krieger had been a member of the commune's so-called Central Committee before Marx had sent him packing. With a price on his head in the Northern Union, he had sailed in steerage from Boston, penniless, under an assumed name, with his wife and child, to join London's thousands of American refugees. These Bowery pantomimes.
Yes.
Oliphant leaned forward. There are factions within the party.
Do go on.
Anarchists disguising themselves as communists, feminists, all manner of incorrect ideologies, you see, covert cells not under Manhattan's control.
I see, Oliphant said, thinking of the reams of yellow fanfold representing the confession of William Collins.
Again on foot, Oliphant made his roundabout way through Soho to Compton Street, where he paused before the entrance of a public house known as the Blue Boar. A sporting gentleman, he was informed by a large bill, a staunch supporter of the destruction of these vermin, would give a gold repeater watch to be killed for by dogs under 13¾ pounds weight. Below the smudged bill, a painted wooden placard advertised, Rats always on hand for the accommodation of gentlemen to try their dogs. He entered, and shortly was greeting Fraser in the rank smell of dogs, tobacco smoke, and hot penny gin. The long bar was crowded with men of every grade of society, many with their animals under their arms. There were bulldogs, Skye terriers, small brown English terriers. The room was low-ceilinged and quite unadorned. About the walls were hung clusters of leather collars.
You came by cab, sir? Fraser inquired.
On foot, from a previous appointment.
Here now, cried the barman. Don't block up the bar.
There was a general movement toward the parlor, where a young waiter now shouted, Give your orders, gentlemen! With Fraser at his side, Oliphant followed the crowd of sporting men and their dogs. Above the parlor fireplace were glass-fronted cases displaying the stuffed heads of animals famous in their day. Oliphant noticed the head of a bull terrier, its glass eyes bulging hugely.
Looks as though this one died of strangulation, Oliphant remarked, pointing the thing out to Fraser.
They've spoilt her in the stuffing, sir, said the waiter, a fair-haired boy in a greasy striped apron.
Good as any in England, she was. I've seen her kill 20 at a go, though they killed her at the last. Your sewer rats are dreadful for giving a dog canker, though we'd always rinse her mouth out well with peppermint and water.
Your Sayers, boy, Fraser said. We want a word with him.
Why, I know you, sir. You were here about that Saventry gent.
Your old dad, Jem, and brisk about it, Fraser interjected, preventing the boy from announcing the arrival of a copper to the assembled sportsmen.
He's upstairs, lighting the pit, sir, the boy said.
Good chap, Oliphant said, giving the boy a shilling. Oliphant and Fraser mounted a broad wooden staircase, which led to what had once been the drawing room. Opening a door, Fraser led the way into the rat-killing apartment.
"Pit's not bloody open," bellowed a fat man with ginger side whiskers. Oliphant saw that the pit consisted of a wooden circus, some 6 feet in diameter, fitted with a high rim at elbow height. Above it branched the arms of an 8-mantle gaslight, brightly illuminating the white-painted floor of the little arena. Mr. Sayers, the Blue Boar's proprietor, in a bulging silk waistcoat, stood with a live rat in his left hand.
"But it's you, Mr. Fraser. My apologies, sir."
Having caught the creature somehow by the throat, he deftly prized out its larger teeth with no more implement than his strong thumbnail.
"Order for a dozen with their teeth drawed."
He dropped the mutilated rat into a rusted wire cage with several others, and turned to face his visitors.
"How might we be of service, Mr. Fraser?"
Fraser took out an engine-stippled morgue portrait.
"Aye, ease your man," Sayers said, his brows rising. "Big chap, long in the leg, and a dead'un by the look of him."
"You're quite positive?" Oliphant could smell the rats now. "This is Professor Rudwick's murderer?"
"Aye, sir. We gets all sorts here, but none too many Argentine giants. I recall him quite plain."
Fraser had taken out his notebook and was writing in it.
"Argentine?" Oliphant asked. "He spoke Spanish," Sayers said, "for so I took it to be. Now, mind you, we none of us saw him do the deed, but he was on the premises that night, so he was."
"Cap'n's here," Sayers' son called from the doorway.
"Hell, and I've not drawed the teeth of half his rats."
"Fraser," Oliphant said, "I fancy a warm gin. Let us retire to the bar and allow Mr. Sayers to complete arrangements for the evening's sport." He bent to examine a larger cage, this one of iron bands. It seemed to contain a solid mound of rats.
"Mind your fingers there," Sayers said, "for believe me, you get a bite and you'll not forget it. These here are none of the cleanest."
In the parlor, a young officer, evidently the captain, was threatening to leave the place if he were kept waiting any longer.
"I shouldn't drink that if I were you," Fraser said, looking at Oliphant's noggin of warm gin. "Almost certainly adulterated."
"Actually, it's quite good," Oliphant said. "It has a very faint aftertaste, rather like bitter wormwood."
"An intoxicant poison."
"Quite. The French use it in the preparation of herbals. What do you make of our good captain here?" Oliphant gestured with his gin, indicating the man in question, who was pacing about in an agitated fashion, examining the paws of various animals as their owners presented them, all the while shouting that he should depart immediately if the pit weren't opened.
"Crimea," Fraser said.
The captain bent to peer at the claws of a young terrier in the arms of a swarthy, rather portly man, whose pomaded spit curls protruded like wings from beneath his high-crowned derby.
"Velasco,"
Fraser said, as if to himself, something nastily akin to pleasure in his tone, and was instantly beside the fellow. The captain started, his handsome young face convulsed with a violent tic, and Oliphant's eye abruptly filled with all the red Crimea, whole cities aflame like bonfires, and shell-churned wastes of jellied filth, sprouting white flowers that were men's hands. He shuddered with the intensity of the vision, then forgot it utterly.
"Do I know you, sir?" the captain inquired of Fraser, with a brittle, murderous jollity.
"Gentlemen," Mr. Sayers cried from the stairs. Led by the captain, the entire company, save only Oliphant, Fraser, the swarthy man, and a fourth man, made for the pit above. The fourth man, perched on the arm of a ragged brocade armchair, began to cough. Oliphant saw Fraser's grip tighten about his prey's upper arm.
"Shouldn't bloody ought to do that, Fraser,"
the man on the chair arm said, unfolding his legs and standing. Oliphant noted a certain calculation evident in his tone. Like the swarthy man, he was newly and nattily kitted out, all in Oxford Street's latest, his coat of engine-cut gabardine dyed a blue that verged on lavender. Oliphant saw that his lapel, like that of his companion, was decorated with a gleaming cloisonné badge in the shape of the Union Jack.
"Bloody, Mr. Tate," Fraser said.
a schoolmaster about to deliver a tongue-lashing, or worse. "Fair warning, Fraser," the swarthy man said, his dark eyes protruding. "We're about parliamentary business." The little brown terrier shivered in his arms. "Are you, then?" Oliphant inquired mildly. "And what business has Parliament in a rat pit?" "Might ask the same of you, eh?" the taller man said insolently, then coughed. Fraser glared at him. "Fraser," Oliphant said, "are these gentlemen the confidential agents you mentioned in regard to Dr. Mallory?"
"Tate and Velasco," Fraser said grimly.
"Mr. Tate," Oliphant said, stepping forward. "A pleasure, sir. I am Lawrence Oliphant, journalist." Tate blinked, confused by Oliphant's cordiality. Fraser, rather reluctantly taking Oliphant's cue, released Velasco's arm. "Mr. Velasco?" Oliphant smiled. Velasco's face clouded with suspicion. "Journalist? What sort of journalist?" he demanded, glancing from Oliphant to Fraser and back.
"Travel pieces, primarily," Oliphant said, "though I'm currently engaged, with Mr. Fraser's able help, in compiling a popular history of the Great Stink."
Tate peered narrowly at Oliphant. "Mallory, you said. What about him?"
"I interviewed Dr. Mallory prior to his departure for China. His experiences during the Stink were most remarkable and highly illustrative of the perils that might befall anyone during such a chaotic period."
"Befall anyone?" Velasco challenged. "Rubbish! Mallory's trouble was Savantry trouble, and your Mr. Fraser knows it well enough."
"Yes, yes, quite," Oliphant agreed. "And that is why I am delighted to have encountered you gentlemen tonight."
Velasco and Tate glanced uncertainly at one another.
"You are?" Tate ventured.
"Utterly. You see, Dr. Mallory explained to me the unfortunate contretemps with his rival and fellow savant, Peter Folk. It seems, you see, that even in the most rarefied circles, during a period of such unprecedented stress..."
"You'll not see Peter Bloody Folk moving in your rarefied bloody circles now," Velasco interjected. "Not for all his gentry posing."
He paused for effect. "He was discovered in bed with a girl not 12 years old."
"No,"
Oliphant feigned shock.
"Folk? But surely..."
"He was," Tate affirmed, "in Brighton. And those as found him beat the bugger silly and flung him stark naked into the street."
"But it wasn't us did that," Velasco stated flatly, "and you'll not prove it was."
"There's a new trend of thought about,"
Tate said, thrusting his shallow chest forward so as to better display his Union Jack insignia, the gin-reddened tip of his button nose glinting wetly, "such as doesn't tolerate decadence," giving equal stress to the word's three syllables, "be it in the Savantry or however high at all. Hidden wickedness ran rife under Byron, all manner of it, and well, you know it, Fraser." Fraser's eyes widened at this effrontery, as Tate turned in his excitement to Oliphant. "That Stink was Ned Ludd's work, mister, and there's your history of it."
"Sabotage on a titanic scale," Velasco pronounced darkly, as if quoting from a speech. "Abetted by conspirators in the highest ranks of society. But there are true patriots among us, sir, patriots at work to root that evil out."
The terrier growled in Velasco's arms, and Fraser looked on the verge of throttling man and dog alike.
"We're parliamentary investigators," Tate said, "about a member's business, and I'm sure you'd not care to detain us."
Oliphant put his hand upon Fraser's sleeve. With a smirk of triumph, Velasco soothed his little dog and sauntered to the stairs. Tate followed. From overhead came the mad yapping of dogs and the hoarse cries of sportsmen.
"They're working for Egremont," Oliphant said.
Fraser's face twisted with disgust. Disgust and something akin to amazement.
"There seems nothing more to be done here, Fraser. I take it you arranged for a cab."
Mr. Mori Arinori,
Oliphant's favorite among his young Japanese pupils, took a fierce delight in all things British. Oliphant, who customarily breakfasted lightly, if at all, would sometimes subject himself to massively English breakfasts to please Maury, who on this particular occasion wore the burliest of golfing tweeds and a scarf in the tartan of the Royal Hibernian Order of Steam Engineers. There was a certain enjoyably melancholy sense of paradox, Oliphant mused, in watching Maury spread a slice of toast with marmalade, while he himself indulged a nostalgia for his own days in Japan, where he had served as first secretary under Rutherford Alcock. His stay in Edo had nurtured in him a passionate regard for the muted tones and subtle textures of a world of ritual and shadow. He longed now for the rattle of rain blown against oiled paper, for flowering weeds anod down tiny alleys, the glow of rush lamps, for scents and darknesses, the shadows of the low city.
Oriphant's son, toast is very good, is most excellent. You are sad, Oriphant-san?
No, Mr. Maury, not at all. He helped himself to bacon, though he wasn't hungry in the least. He put aside a sudden intrusive memory of the morning's hideous bath, the black clinging rubber. I was recalling Edo. That city possessed great charm for me. Maury chewed bread and marmalade, regarding Oliphant steadily with his bright dark eyes, then dabbed expertly at his lips with a linen napkin.
Charm. Your word for the old ways. The old ways hinder my nation. Only this week have I posted to Satsuma an argument against the wearing of swords.
The bright eyes darted, for a fractional moment, toward the crooked fingers of Oliphant's left hand. As if stung by the pressure of Maury's awareness, the scar beneath Oliphant's cuff began a slow ache. But, Mr. Maury, Oliphant said, setting his silver fork aside to abandon the unwanted bacon, the sword in your country is in many respects the focal symbol of the feudal ethic and the sentiments attaching to it, an object of reverence second only to one's own lord. Maury smiled, pleased.
Odious custom of rude and savage age. This is good to be rid of, Oriphant-san. This is modern day.
This latter a favorite and frequent expression. Oliphant returned the smile. Maury combined boldness and compassion with a certain problematical brashness that Oliphant found most appealing. More than once, to Bly's dismay, Maury had paid some Cockney cabman, full fare plus tip, and then invited the fellow into Oliphant's kitchen for a meal.
But you must learn to proceed apace, Mr. Maury. While you yourself may regard the wearing of swords as a primitive custom, to openly oppose this minor matter might well provoke resistance to other more important reforms, the deeper changes you wish to implement in your society.
Maury nodded gravely.
Your policy no doubt has merit, Oriphant-san. Far better, for example, if all Japanese were taught English. Our meager tongue is of no use in the great world beyond our islands. Soon power of steam and the engine must pervade our land. English language, following such, must suppress any use of Japanese. Our intelligent race, eager in pursuit of knowledge, cannot depend on weak and uncertain medium of communication. They must grasp principal truths from precious treasury of Western science.
Oliphant tilted his head to one side, considering Maury carefully.
Mr. Maury, he said, pardon me if I misunderstand you, but am I correct in assuming that you are proposing nothing less than the deliberate abolition of the Japanese language? This is modern day, Oriphant-san, modern day. All reasons support our tongue's disuse.
Oliphant smiled. We must arrange to discuss this at length, Mr. Maury. But now I must ask if you are engaged this evening. I propose an entertainment.
By all means, Oriphant-san. English social festivities are ever gratifying.
Maury beamed. We shall go then to Whitechapel, to the Garrick Theatre, for what I understand is a most unusual pantomime. According to the spottily stippled program, the clown was known as Jackdaw Jaculation, though this was perhaps the least peculiar aspect of that evening's performance by the Manhattan Women's Red Pantomime Troupe of Mazulam the Night Owl. Other characters included Freedman Bureau Bill, a black boy, Levy Stickmall, a merchant, offering 2 cigars for 5 cents, a Yankee peddler, a lady shoplifter, a roast turkey, and the eponymous Mazulam. All of the players, to judge by the program, were female, though in several cases this would otherwise have been quite impossible to determine. The clown, ornate with frills, in elaborately spangled satin, boasted an egg-bald shaven pate and the sinister white face of the Pierrot, touched with color only in the outlined lips. The performance had been preceded by a brief ranting address from one Helen America, her heaving, apparently unconstrained bosom, through layers of diaphanous scarves, serving to hold the attention of the predominantly masculine audience. Her speech had consisted of slogans Oliphant found rather more cryptic than rousing. What exactly did it mean, for instance, when she declared that we have nothing to wear but our chains? Consulting the program, he was informed that Helen America was in fact the authoress of Mazulam the Night Owl, as well as Harlequin Panataha and the Genii of the Algonquins. Musical accompaniment was provided by a moon-faced organist, her eyes, it seemed to Oliphant, glinting either with lunacy or laudanum. The pantomime had opened in what Oliphant supposed was meant to be taken as a hotel dining room, with the peripatetic roast turkey, apparently played by a dwarf, attacking the diners with a carving knife. Oliphant had very quickly lost track of the narrative, if indeed there were one, which he doubted. Scenes were punctuated repeatedly by characters firing stuffed bricks at one another's heads. There was kinetropic accompaniment of a sort, though it consisted of crudely polemical cartoons that seemed to bear little relationship to the action. Oliphant stole a glance at Maury, who sat beside him, his treasured topper upright on his lap, his face expressionless. The audience was howlingly rowdy, though less in response to the substance of the pantomime, whatever that might be, than to the whirling, curiously formless dances of the communard women, their bare shins and ankles plainly visible beneath the ragged hems of their flowing garments. Oliphant's back began to ache. The choreography accelerated into a sort of balletic assault, the air thick with brickbats, until, quite abruptly, Mazulam the Night Owl was ended. The crowd hooted, applauded, jeered. Oliphant noted a hulking, gaunt-jawed man with a stout rattan over his shoulder, lounging beside the entrance to the pit. The fellow was watching the crowd through narrowed eyes. "Come then, Mr. Maury, I sense a journalistic opportunity." Maury stood, hat and evening cane in hand. He followed Oliphant toward the pit. "Lawrence Oliphant, journalist." He presented his card to the hulking man. "If you would be so kind, you might convey this to Miss America with my request for an interview." The man took the card, glanced at it, and let it fall to the floor. Oliphant saw the knobby fist tighten around the rattan. Maury emitted a brief hiss, as if of steam. Oliphant turned. Maury, his top hat jammed firmly forward on his head, had assumed the pose of the samurai warrior, the handle of his evening cane grasped in both his hands. Immaculate linen and gold links glinted at his supple wrists. The untidily coiffed, extravagantly hennaed head of Helen America appeared. Her eyes were ringed with kohl. Maury held his pose. "Miss Helen America?" Oliphant produced a second card. "Allow me to introduce myself. I am Lawrence Oliphant, journalist." Helen America performed a rapid manipulation before the stony face of her compatriot, as though she were conjuring something from the air. The man lowered his length of rattan, still glowering fiercely at Maury. The stick, Oliphant saw, was obviously weighted. "Cecil's a deaf-mute," she said, pronouncing the name with a case-hardened American E. "I'm very sorry. I offered my card.
He can't read. You say you're a newspaper man.
An occasional journalist. And you, Miss America, are an authoress of the first water. Allow me to introduce my good friend, Mr. Mori Arinori, an envoy of the Mikado of Japan. With a deadly glance at Cecil, Mori reversed his cane with admirable grace, removed his hat, and bowed in the European fashion. Helen America, wide-eyed, regarded him as one might a trained dog. She wore a neatly mended military cloak, threadbare but apparently clean, in the shade of gray the Confederates called butternut, though the original regimental buttons had been replaced with plain round horn. "I haven't ever seen a Chinaman dressed like that," she said. "Mr. Mori is Japanese." "And you're a newspaper man?" "After a fashion, yes." Helen America smiled, revealing a gold tooth. "And did you enjoy our show?" "It was extraordinary, quite extraordinary." Her smile widened. "Then come to Manhattan, mister, for the people risen have the old Olympic, east of Broadway, over Houston Street. We're best appreciated in our own venue." Thin bands of silver pierced her ears, amid a tangled cloud of hennaed curls. "It would be my great pleasure, as it would be my pleasure to conduct an interview with the authoress of..." "I didn't write that," she said. "Fox did."
"Pardon me?"
"George Washington Lafayette Fox, the Marxian Grimaldi, the Tamla of socialist pantomime. It was the troops' decision to put that I wrote it, though I continue to argue against it." "But your prefatory message..." "Now, I did write that, sir, and am proud of it. But poor Fox..." "I hadn't heard," Oliphant submitted, somewhat baffled. "It was the terrible pressure of toil," she said. "The great Fox, who'd single-handedly elevated socialist pantomime to its present level of revolutionary importance, was sweated mad by one-night stands, sir, driven to sheer exhaustion at having to contrive sharper tricks and quicker transformations. He slid into dementia then, his grimaces hideous to behold." She had assumed her stage delivery. Now she lapsed back into a more confidential tone. "He'd lapse into the crudest indecency, mister, so we kept his dresser in a monkey suit to run out and belabor him if he got too obscene." "I'm very sorry." "Manhattan's no place for the mad, sir, sad to say. He's in the asylum in Somerville, Massachusetts, and if you'd care to publish that, be my guest." Oliphant found that he was staring at her, entirely at a loss for words. Mori Arinori had retired somewhat, and seemed to be watching the crowd as it made its way out of the garrick. The deaf-mute Cecil had vanished, taking with him his shot-loaded length of rattan. "I could eat a horse," Helen America said cheerfully. "Allow me, please, to provide you with a meal. Where do you wish to dine?" "There's a place around the corner." As she stepped from the topmost of the steps that ascended the pit, Oliphant saw that she wore a pair of the rubber boots Americans called Chickamaugas, great clumsy things of military origin. With Mori at his side, he followed her out of the garrick. She had not waited for him to offer his arm. She led them down the street, and as she had said, around a corner. Gaslight flared before a clacking kino sign that checkered from Moses and Sons Auto Cafe into Clean, Modern, Rapid, and back again. Helen America glanced back with an encouraging smile, her Calipigian hips swaying beneath the Confederate cloak and the tattered muslin of her remarkable stage garment. The auto cafe was crowded and noisy, packed with Whitechapel locals. Its iron-mullioned windows were opaque with steam. Oliphant had seen nothing like it before. Helen America demonstrated how business was conducted here, taking up a rectangular gutta-percha tray from a stack of the things and pushing it along a ledge of shining zinc. Above the ledge were several dozen miniature windows trimmed with brass. Oliphant and Mori followed her example. Behind each window, a different dish was displayed. Oliphant, noting the coin slots, fumbled for his change purse. Helen America chose a slice of shepherd's pie, a helping of toad in the hole, and fried chips, Oliphant providing the requisite coinage.
An additional tuppence produced a copious quantity of very dubious-looking brown gravy from a spigot. Maury chose a baked potato, a particular favorite of his, but declined the gravy spigot. Oliphant, disoriented by the oddness of the place, opted for a pint of machine-made ale from another spigot. "Clystra's liable to kill me for this," Helen America remarked as they arranged their trays on a ridiculously small cast-iron table. The table, like the four chairs around it, was bolted into the concrete floor. "Doesn't hold with us talking to gentlemen of the press." She shrugged beneath her butternut cloak. She smiled happily and began to sort a small pile of cheap tinware, giving Maury a knife and dinner fork. "Have you been to a town called Brighton, mister?" "Yes, actually, I have." "What kind of place is that?" Maury was examining with keen interest the rectangular dish of coarse gray cardboard beneath his potato. "It's very pleasant," Oliphant said. "Very picturesque. The hydropathic pavilion is quite famous." "Is it in England?" Helen America asked, around a mouthful of toad in the hole. "It is, yes." "Lots of working folks?" "Perhaps not, in the sense I take you to mean, though the various facilities and attractions employ a great many people." "Haven't seen a real factory crowd since we got here. Well, let's eat." And with that, Helen America bent to the task. Dinner conversation, Oliphant gathered, was not highly valued in Red Manhattan. She left the cardboard dishes, utterly devoid of scraps or crumbs, contriving to sop up the last dross of gravy with a chip she had carefully retained for this purpose. Oliphant took out his notebook. Opening it, he removed a plain white card stippled with Florence Bartlett's Bow Street portrait. "Are you familiar at all with Flora Barnett, the American actress, Miss America? She's enormously popular in Manhattan, or so I was recently told." Oliphant displayed the card. "She's no actress, mister, nor an American either. She's a Southern, if you can even call her that. Next thing to a damn Frenchie. The people risen don't need her kind. Hell, we've already hung our share of 'em." "Her kind?" Helen America met his gaze with a defiant stare. "In a pig's eye, you're a journalist. I'm sorry if... sorry like the rest of 'em. You give just about that much of a damn. Miss America, please, I wish only to... Thanks for the feed, mister, but you can't pump me, understand? And that brontosaur, that's got no damn business over here in the first place. You got no right to it, and one day it'll sit in the Manhattan Metropolitan, for it belongs to the people risen. And what makes you limeys think you can come digging up the people's natural treasures?" And in through the door, as if on cue, marched the very formidable clown of the Manhattan Women's Red Pantomime Troupe, her bald pate hugely bonneted in polka-dot gingham, and her Chickamauga boots even larger than Helen America's. "Coming right this minute, Comrade Clystra," Helen America said. The clown fixed Oliphant with a murderous glare, and then the two were gone. Oliphant looked at Maury. "A peculiar evening, Mr. Maury." Maury, apparently lost in contemplation of the auto cafe's clatter and bustle, took a moment to respond. "We will have places such as this in my country, Oriphant-san. Clean, modern, rapid." Bly, upon Oliphant's return to Half Moon Street, followed him upstairs to the door of the study. "May I come in for a moment, sir?" Locking the door behind them with his own key, Bly crossed to a miniature parquet bureau that supported Oliphant's smoking things. Unsealing the top of a humidor, he reached inside and removed a squat little cylinder of black japanned tin. "This was brought round to the kitchen door by a young man, sir. He wouldn't give his name when asked. I took the liberty of opening it myself, sir, recalling some of the more heathen attempts abroad." Oliphant took the canister and unscrewed its lid. Perforated telegraph tape. "And the young man?" "A junior engine clerk, sir, to judge by the state of his shoes. aside from the fact that he wore a clerk's cotton gloves, which he didn't remove.
And there was no message?
There was, sir. Tell him, he said, that we can do no more. There is great danger. He mustn't ask again.
I see.
Would you mind bringing up a pot of strong green tea? Alone, Oliphant set about removing the heavy glass from his personal receiving telegraph, a matter of loosening four brass wing screws. Placing the tall vitrine-like dome out of harm's way, he spent some minutes consulting the maker's instructional manual. After rummaging through several drawers, he located the requisite implements, a walnut-handled brass hand crank, and a small gilt screwdriver embossed with the monogram of the Colton Maxwell Company. He located the knife switch at the base of the instrument and severed the electrical connection with the post office. He then used the screwdriver to make the necessary adjustments, carefully threaded the end of the tape onto the bright steel sprockets, locked the guide plates into position, and took a deep breath. He was all at once aware of the beating of his own heart, and of the night's silence pressing in from the darkness of Green Park, and of the eye. He took up the crank, thrust its hexagonal tip into the mechanism's socket, and began, steadily but slowly, to turn it clockwise. The character hammers began to rise and fall, deciphering the punch code of the post office tape. He refused to look at it as it emerged from the slot. It was done. With scissors and paste pot, he assembled the message on a sheet of foolscap. Dear Charles, 9 years ago you put me to the worst dishonor that a woman can know. Stop. Charles, you promised me that you would save my poor father. Stop. Instead, you corrupted me, body and soul. Stop. Today I am leaving London, in the company of powerful friends. Stop. They know very well what a traitor you were to Walter Gerard, and to me. Stop. Do not attempt to find me, Charles. Stop. It would be useless. Stop. I do hope that you and Mrs. Egremont will sleep soundly tonight. Stop. Sybil Gerard. End it. Only barely aware of Bligh arriving with the tea, he sat unmoving for the better part of an hour, the message before him. Then, after pouring himself a cup of lukewarm tea, he gathered stationery, took out his reservoir pen, and began to compose, in his flawless diplomat's French, a letter to a certain Monsieur Arslau of Paris. Flash powder still stank in the air. The Prince Consort turned, with his full Teutonic gravity, from an elaborate stereoptic camera of Swiss manufacture, and greeted Oliphant in German. He wore aquamarine spectacles, their circular lenses no larger than florins, and was draped in a photographer's smock of spotless white duck. His fingers were stained with silver nitrate. Oliphant bowed, wishing His Highness a good afternoon in what amounted to the royal family's language of choice, and pretended to examine the Swiss camera, an intricate creation whose stereoptic lenses, like eyes, stared from beneath a smooth brass brow. Like the eyes of Mr. Cart, the consort's muscular Swiss valet, they struck Oliphant as being set rather too widely apart. "I've brought Affy a little gift, Your Highness," Oliphant said. His German, like the Prince Consort's, had the accent of Saxony, the legacy of a prolonged and delicate mission Oliphant had undertaken there at the behest of the royal family. Prince Albert's Coburg relatives, ever ingenious at the ancient craft of marriage politics, were eager to expand their tiny domain, a delicate matter indeed, when the policy of the British Foreign Office was to keep the German mini-states as fragmented as politically possible. "Has the young prince concluded his day's lessons?" "Affy is ill today," Albert said, peering through his tinted spectacles at one of the camera's lenses. He produced a small brush and lightly whisked at the surface of the lens. He straightened.
Do you think the study of statistics too much a burden for a tender young mind?
My opinion, Your Highness, Oliphant said. Statistical analysis is indeed a powerful technique.
His mother and I disagree on the matter, the prince confided mournfully. And Alfred's progress in the subject is far from satisfactory. Nevertheless, statistics is the key to the future. Statistics are everything in England.
Does he progress well in his other studies? Oliphant hedged.
Anthropometry, the prince suggested absently. Eugenics, powerful fields of learning, but less taxing, perhaps, to the youthful brain.
Perhaps I might have a word with him, Your Highness, Oliphant said. I know the lad means well.
He is in his room, no doubt, the prince said. Oliphant made his way through the drafty glamour of the royal apartments to Alfred's room, where he was greeted with a whoop of glee, the prince scrambling in bare feet from mounded bedclothes and hopping nimbly across the tracks of a most elaborate miniature railway.
Uncle Larry! Uncle Larry! Brilliant! What have you brought for me?
Baron's orders latest. In Oliphant's pocket, wrapped in green tissue and smelling strongly of cheap fresh ink, was a copy of Pater Noster the Steam Bandit by one Baron Zorda, the third volume in the popular series, young Prince Alfred having expressed his unbridled enthusiasm for the two previous numbers, The Skeleton Army and Wheelman of the Tsar. The book's garishly colored cover depicted the daring Pater Noster, pistol in hand, climbing from the cabin of a hurtling vehicle one took to be a gurney in the latest style, sheathed in tin, bulbous at the prow, and very narrow in the rear. The frontispiece, which Oliphant had examined in the Piccadilly newsagents where he had purchased the volume, offered Baron Zorda's raffish highwayman in rather more detail, particularly in regard to his dress, which included a broad belt of studded leather and bell-bottomed trousers with buttoned vents at the cuffs.
Super!
The boy eagerly tore the green tissue from Pater Noster the Steam Bandit.
Look at his gurney, Uncle Larry. Its line streamed like 60.
Nothing but the swiftest for wicked Pater Noster, Affy. And see the frontispiece. He's got up like Smashjaw Ned.
Look at his narrow go-wides, Alfred said admiringly, and his bloody great belt.
And how have you been, Affy? Oliphant asked, ignoring the boy's lapse in language, since my last visit.
Very well, Uncle Larry.
And a shadow of anxiety crossed the young face.
But I'm afraid she's broken, you see.
The prince pointed to where the Japanese tea doll slumped disconsolately against the foot of the massive four-poster, surrounded by a tumbled sea of lithographed tin and painted lead. A long, sharp sliver of some translucent material protruded grotesquely from her gorgeous robe.
It's the spring, you see. I think it was wound too tightly, Uncle Larry. It sprang right out on the 10th turn.
The Japanese power their dolls with springs of baleen, Effie. Whale whiskers, they call the stuff. They haven't yet learned from us the manufacture of proper springs, but soon they shall. When they do, their dolls shan't break so easily.
Father says you're too keen on your Japanese, Alfred said. He says you think them the equal of Europeans.
And I do, Effie. Their mechanical appliances are presently inferior, due to their lack of knowledge in the applied sciences. Some day, in futurity, they may lead civilization to heights yet untold. They, and perhaps the Americans. The boy regarded him dubiously.
Father wouldn't like that at all, what you said.
No, I rather doubt he would. Oliphant then spent half an hour down on his knees upon the carpet, watching Alfred demonstrate a toy French engine, operated, as was its cousin, the Great Napoleon, by compressed air. The little engine employed lengths of telegraph tape, rather than cards, reminding Oliphant of his letter to Monsieur Arslau. Well, I would have taken it round to the French embassy by now. Very likely it was already on its way to Paris by diplomatic pouch. Alfred was connecting his engine to a miniature kinetrope. There came a ceremonious rattle at the doorknob. The doors of Buckingham Palace were never knocked.
Oliphant rose and opened the tall white portal to discover the well-known face of Nash, a palace valet de chambre, whose unwise speculations in railway shares had briefly made him the unwilling intimate of the Metropolitan Fraud Bureau. Oliphant's politesse had successfully smoothed the matter, a kindness well invested, he saw now, by Nash's unfeigned air of respectful attention. "Mr. Oliphant," Nash announced, "a telegram has come, sir. Most urgent." The velocity of the special branch vehicle contributed in no small part to Oliphant's general sense of unease. Paternoster himself could have asked for nothing faster, or more radically line-streamed. They flew past St. James's Park with the speed of dream, the bare black branches of the lime trees flashing by like wind-driven smoke. The driver wore leather goggles with round lenses, and plainly relished their headlong flight, periodically sounding a deep-throated whistle that sent horses rearing and pedestrians scurrying. The stoker, a burly young Irishman, was grinning maniacally as he shoveled coke into the burner. Oliphant had no idea of their destination. Now, as they neared Trafalgar, the traffic caused the driver to yank the whistle cord continually, steadily, setting up a mournful, bellowing ululation, like the grief of some marine behemoth. The traffic at this sound parted like the Red Sea before Moses. Helmeted policemen saluted smartly as they sped past. Urchins and crossing sweepers turned cartwheels of delight at the sight of a sleek tin fish racketing down the strand. The evening had grown quite dark. As they entered Fleet Street, the driver applied the brake and worked a lever that released a mighty gout of uprushing steam. The line-streamed gurney bumped to a halt. "Well, sir," the driver commented, raising his goggles to peer through the fretted glass of the vehicle's prow. "Would you look at that?" Traffic, Oliphant saw, had been halted completely by the erection of wooden barricades hung with lanterns. Behind these stood grim-faced soldiers in combat drab, Cutts Maudsley carbines unslung and at the ready. Beyond them he saw sheets of canvas loosely hung from raw timber uprights, as though someone were attempting to erect stage scenery in the middle of Fleet Street. The stoker swabbed his face with a polka-dot Kingsman. "Something here the press aren't meant to see." "They've put it in the wrong street, then," the driver said, "haven't they?" As Oliphant climbed from the gurney, Fraser came walking quickly toward him. "We've found her," Fraser said glumly, "and seemed to have attracted considerable publicity in the process. Perhaps a few less infantry would be in order." "It isn't a matter for levity, Mr. Oliphant. You'd best come with me." "Is Betteridge here?"
"Haven't seen him. This way, please."
Fraser led the way between a pair of barricades. A soldier curtly nodded them past. Oliphant glimpsed a mustachioed gentleman in urgent conversation with two metropolitans. "That's Halliday," he said, "Chief of Criminal Anthropometry."
"Yes, sir," Fraser said.
"They're all over this one. The Museum of Practical Geology has been broken into. The Royal Society is angry as a nest of hornets, and Bloody Egremont will be in every first edition, calling it a Luddite outrage. Our only bit of luck would seem to be that Dr. Mallory is well away in China."
"Mallory? Why is that?"
"The Land Leviathan. Mrs. Bartlett and her cohorts attempted to make away with the thing's skull." They rounded one of the makeshift barriers, its coarse fabric stamped at intervals with the broad arrow mark of the Army Ordnance Department. A cab horse lay on its side in a great pool of darkening blood. The cab, a common one-horse fly, was overturned nearby, its dull black lacquered panels stitched with bullet holes.
"She was with two men," Fraser said. "Three, if you count a corpse they left behind in the museum. The hack was driven by a Yankee exile called Russell, a Bully Rock bruiser living in Seven Dials. The other man was Henry Dees of Liverpool, quite the accomplished cracksman. I'd our Henry in dock 10 times when I was on the force, but no more. They're laid out there, sir." He pointed. Russell, the driver, evidently got into a shouting match with a real cabman over who should give way. A metropolitan on traffic duty attempted to intervene, at which point Russell produced a pistol.
Oliphant was staring at the overturned cab. The traffic officer was unarmed, but a pair of Bow Street detectives happened to be passing.
But this cab, Fraser...
That's the work of an army gurney, sir. The last of the temporary garrisons is just by the Hoban Viaduct. He paused. Dees had a Russian shotgun.
Oliphant shook his head in disbelief.
8 civilians taken to hospital, Fraser said. 1 detective dead. But come along, sir. Best we get this done with.
What is the meaning of these canvas screens?
Criminal anthropometry ordered them.
Oliphant felt as though he were moving through a dream, his limbs numb and without volition. He allowed himself to be led to where 3 canvas-draped bodies were arranged upon stretchers. The face of Florence Bartlett was a hideous ruin.
Vitriol, Fraser said. A bullet shattered whatever container she employed.
Oliphant turned quickly away, retching into his handkerchief.
Sorry, sir, Fraser said. No point in you seeing the other two.
Betteridge, Fraser. Have you seen him?
No, sir. Here's the skull, sir, or what remains of it.
The skull?
Perhaps 6 massive fragments of petrified bone and ivory-tinted plaster were neatly arranged atop a varnished trestle table. There's a Mr. Reeks here, from the museum, come to take it back, Fraser said. Says it isn't as badly damaged as we might think. Would you like to sit down, sir? I could find you a folding stool.
No. Why does there seem to be fully 1/2 of criminal anthropometry about, Fraser?
Well, sir, you're in a better position to determine that than I, Fraser said, lowering his voice, though I've heard it said that Mr. Egremont and Lord Galton have recently discovered they've much in common.
Lord Galton? The eugenics theorist?
Lord Darwin's cousin, that is. He's anthropometry's man in the House of Lords. Has a deal of influence in the Royal Society.
Fraser brought out his notebook.
You'd best see why I thought it urgent you come here, sir.
He led Oliphant back around the ruin of the cab. Glancing about for possible observers, he passed Oliphant a fold of blue flimsy.
I took it from the Bartlett woman's reticule.
The note was undated, unsigned. That which you so persistently desire has been located, albeit in a most peculiar hiding place. I am informed by our mutual acquaintance of the Derby, Dr. Mallory, that it has been sealed up within the skull of his land Leviathan. I would hope that you will consider this crucial intelligence a full repayment of all my debts to you. I am in some peril now from recent political developments, and certainly I am observed by elements of government. Pray consider that in any further attempt to communicate. I have done all that I can, I swear it.
The elegant hand, as familiar to Oliphant as it was to Fraser, was Lady Ada Byron's. The 2 of us alone have seen that, Fraser said.
Oliphant folded the paper in quarters before putting it away in his cigar case. And what exactly was it, Fraser, that was hidden in the skull?
I'll escort you back through the line, sir.
Reporters surged forward as Fraser and Oliphant emerged from the barricades. Fraser took Oliphant's arm and led him into a cluster of helmeted metropolitans, some of whom he greeted casually by name.
To answer your question, Mr. Oliphant, Fraser said, the policeman walling off the shouting crowd behind blue serge and brass buttons, I don't know, but we have it.
You do? By whose authority?
None but my own lights, Fraser said. Harris here, he found it in the cab, before anthropometry arrived.
Fraser very nearly smiled.
The boys on the force aren't too keen on anthropometry. Bloody-minded amateurs. Aye, Harris?
Aye, sir, said a metropolitan with blonde side whiskers. They are that.
Where is it, then? Oliphant asked.
Here, sir.
Harris produced a cheap black satchel.
Just as we found it, in this.
Mr. Oliphant, sir, I think you'd best take that straight away, Fraser said.
Indeed, Fraser, I agree.
Tell the special branch chap in the fancy gurney that I won't be needing him.
Thank you, Harris. Good evening.
The policeman parted smoothly. Oliphant, satchel in hand, strode smartly out through the throng who jostled for a better view of the soldiers and the canvas screens.
"Pardon, Gov, but could you spare a copper?"
Oliphant looked down into the squinting brown eyes of Little Boots, every inch the crippled jockey. He was neither. Oliphant threw him a penny. Boots caught it adroitly, then edged forward on his cut-down crutch. He stank of damp fustian and smoked mackerel.
"Trouble, Gov. Becky'll tear you."
Boots wheeled about on his crutch and hobbled determinedly away, muttering as he went, a beggar intent upon finding a better pitch. He was one of Oliphant's two most talented watchers. The other, Becky Dean, kept pace beside Oliphant as he neared the corner of Chancery Lane. She was gotten up as a rather successful tart, brass-heeled and brazen.
"Where has Betteridge got to?" Oliphant asked, as if talking to himself.
"Taken," Becky Dean said, "not 3 hours ago."
"Taken by whom?"
"Two men in a hack. They'd been following you. Betteridge got on to them, then set us to watching the watchers."
"I knew nothing of this."
"Day before yesterday he came to us."
"And who were these men?"
"One's a greasy little ponce of a private detective. Velasco, his name is. The other was government by the look of him.
He was taken in broad daylight, by force."
"You know well enough how it's done,"
Becky Dean said.
In the soothing reek of his tobacconist's quiet stockroom, at the corner of Chancery Lane and Carey Street, Oliphant held the corner of the blue flimsy above the concise jet of a bronze cigar lighter in the shape of a turbaned Turk. He watched the paper reduce itself to delicate pinkish ash. The satchel had contained a Ballester Molina automatic revolver, a silvered brass pocket flask filled with some sickly sweet-scented decoction, and a wooden case. This last was plainly the object in question, encrusted as it was with raw white plaster. It held a very large number of engine cards in the Napoleon gauge, cut from a novel material, milky and very smooth to the touch. "The parcel," he said to Mr. Beeden, the tobacconist, "is to be held for me alone."
"Certainly, sir."
"My man Bly, to be the sole exception."
"As you wish, sir."
"If any inquiry at all should be made, Beeden, please send a boy round to advise Bly."
"Our pleasure, sir."
"Thank you, Beeden. Could you possibly give me £40 cash against my account?"
"40, sir?"
"Yes."
"Yes, I could, sir. With pleasure, Mr. Oliphant."
Mr. Beeden took a ring of keys from his coat and went to unlock an admirably modern-looking safe and a dozen prime Havanas. "And Beeden?"
"Yes, sir?"
"I think it might be a very good idea if you were to keep the parcel in your safe there."
"Of course, sir."
"I believe that the Lambs is nearby, Beeden? The dining club?"
"Yes, sir. Holborn, sir. A short walk."
The year's first snow began to fall as he made his way up Chancery Lane, a dry, gritty stuff that seemed unlikely to adhere to the paving. Boots and Becky Dean were nowhere to be seen, which could reliably be taken to mean that they were about their customarily invisible business.
"You know well enough how it's done."
And didn't he? How many had been made to vanish, vanish utterly, in London alone? How could one sit among friends at pleasant little dinners, sipping Moselle, listening to kind and careless talk, yet carry in one's mind the burden of such knowledge? He'd meant Collins to be the last, absolutely the last. Now Betteridge had gone, and at the hands of another agency. In the beginning, it had made so horribly elegant a sort of sense. In the beginning, it had been his idea. The eye. He sensed it now. Yes, surely, its all-seeing gaze full upon him, as he nodded to the tasseled doorman and entered the marbled vestibule of the Lambs, Andrew Wakefield's dining club. Brass letter boxes, a telegraph booth,
an excess of French-polished veneer, all thoroughly modern. He glanced back, through glass doors, to the street. Opposite the Lambs, beyond twin streams of snow-dusted traffic, he glimpsed a solitary figure in a tall derby hat. A page directed him to the grill room, which was done in dark oak, with an enormous fireplace topped with a mantle of carved Italian stone. "Lawrence Oliphant," he told the tightly jacketed head waiter, "for Mr. Andrew Wakefield." A look of unease crossed the man's face. "I'm sorry, sir, but he isn't..." "Thank you," Oliphant said, "but I believe I see Mr. Wakefield." With the head waiter at his heels, Oliphant marched between the tables, diners turning as he passed. "Andrew," he said, arriving at Wakefield's table, "how very fortunate to find you here." Wakefield was dining alone. He seemed to experience a temporary difficulty in swallowing. "Mr. Wakefield, sir," the head waiter began. "My friend will be joining me," Wakefield said. "Sit down, please. We're attracting attention." "Thank you." Oliphant took a seat. "Will you be dining, sir?" the head waiter asked. "No, thank you." When they were alone, Wakefield sighed loudly. "Damn it all, Oliphant, but didn't I make my terms clear?" "What exactly is it, Andrew, of which you've become so frightened?" "It should be fairly obvious." "Should it? Lord Galton's in league with your bloody Mr. Egremont. He's the great patron of criminal anthropometry, always has been. Their virtual founder. He's Charles Darwin's cousin, Oliphant, and he wields great influence in the House of Lords." "Yes, and in the Royal Society, and in the Geographical as well. I'm thoroughly familiar with Lord Galton, Andrew. He espouses the systematic breeding of the human species." Wakefield put down his knife and fork. "Criminal anthropometry have effectively taken over the Bureau. For all intents and purposes, the Central Statistics Bureau is now under Egremont's control." Oliphant watched as Wakefield's upper teeth began to worry at his lower lip. "I've just come from Fleet Street," Oliphant said. "The level of violence in this society," and he drew the baluster Molina from within his coat, "or rather, I should say, the level of unacknowledged violence, has become remarkable, don't you think, Andrew?" He placed the revolver on the linen between them. "Take this pistol as an example, all too readily obtainable, I'm told. It is of Franco-Mexican manufacture, though the invention of Spaniards. Certain of its internal parts, I am informed, springs and whatnot, are actually British, available on the open market. It becomes rather difficult, then, to say where a weapon like this comes from. Emblematic of something in our current situation, don't you think?" Wakefield had gone quite white. "But I seem to have upset you, Andrew. I'm sorry." "They'll erase us," Wakefield said. "We'll cease to exist. There'll be nothing left, nothing to prove either of us ever lived. Not a check stub, not a mortgage in a city bank, nothing whatever." "Exactly what I'm on about, Andrew." "Don't take that moral tone with me, sir," Wakefield said. "Your lot began it, Oliphant. The disappearances, the files gone missing, the names expunged, numbers lost, histories edited to suit specific ends. No, don't take that tone with me." Oliphant could think of nothing to say. He rose, leaving the pistol on the tablecloth, and left the grill room without looking back. "Pardon me," he said in the marbled vestibule to a burgundy-jacketed bellman who was sifting cigar ends from a sand-filled marble urn. "But could you please direct me to the office of the club steward?" "You bet," the bellman said, or some similar bit of American dialect, and led Oliphant smartly away down a corridor lined with mirrors and rubber plants. 55 minutes later, having toured the club's premises at some length, having been shown a photographic album of the Lamb's annual gambles, having applied for membership, and having paid a not inconsiderable initiation fee, non-refundable, via his own number in the National Credit, Oliphant shook hands with the pomaded steward, gave the man a pound note, and requested that he be let out by the club's most obscure trade entrance.
This proved to be a scullery door which opened on exactly the sort of dank and narrow passage he had hoped for. Within a quarter of an hour he stood at the public bar of a crowded house in Bedford Road, reviewing the text of the telegram that one Sybil Gerard had once dispatched to Mr. Charles Egremont, M.P. of Belgravia.
"Lost both me boys a sickness in the Crimea, squire, and in it all as the telegram comes, in it."
Oliphant folded the sheet of foolscap into his cigar case. He watched his dim reflection in the polished zinc of the bar. He looked at his empty tumbler. He looked up at the woman, a raddled harridan in rags gone a color that had no name, her cheeks roseate with gin blossoms under a patina of grime. "No," he said, "that tragedy is not mine."
"Me Roger it was," she said, "and Tommy lad too, and not a rag come home, squire, not a bloody rag."
He handed her a coin. She thanked him, mumbling, and retreated. He seemed to have thoroughly slipped the traces for the moment. He was entirely alone. It was time to find a cab. In the dim high hollow of the great station, a thousand voices seemed to mingle, the constituent elements of language reduced to the oral equivalent of fog, homogeneous and impenetrable. Oliphant went about his business below at a measured and deliberate pace, purchasing a first-class railway ticket to Dover, reserved, for the 10 o'clock evening express. The ticket clerk seated Oliphant's national credit plate in the machine and cranked hard on the lever.
"There you are, sir, reserved in your name."
Thanking the clerk, Oliphant made his way to a second wicket, where he again produced his plate. "I wish to book a cabinet on the morning mailboat to Ostend." Apparently as an afterthought, as he was putting the boat tickets and his national credit plate into his note case, he requested a second-class ticket on the midnight boat to Calais.
"Would that be this evening, sir?"
"Yes."
"That would be the Bessemer, sir. On national credit, sir?"
Oliphant paid for the ticket to Calais with pound notes from Mr. Beeden's safe. 10 till 9 by his father's gold hunter. At 9 o'clock he boarded a departing train at the last possible moment, paying the first-class fare to Dover directly to the conductor. The swinging saloon ship Bessemer, her twin turtle decks awash with Dover spray, steamed for Calais sharp on the midnight. Oliphant, having visited the purser with his second-class ticket and his pound notes, was seated in a brocade armchair in the saloon cabin, sipping mediocre brandy and taking the measure of his fellow passengers. They were, he was pleased to note, a thoroughly unremarkable lot. He disliked swinging saloons, finding the engine-controlled movements of the cabin, intended to compensate for the vessel's pitch and roll, somehow more unsettling than the ordinary motion of a ship at sea. In addition, the cabin itself was effectively windowless. Swung on gimbals in a central well, the cabin was mounted so deeply in the hull that its windows, such as they were located high up along the walls, well above one's line of sight. All in all, as a remedy for mal de mer, Oliphant thought it excessive. The public, however, were apparently fascinated by the novel employment of a small engine, somewhat on the order of a gunnery engine, whose sole task consisted of maintaining as near a level footing in the cabin as was deemed possible. This was accomplished via something the press referred to, in Clacker's argot, as backfeed. Still, with twin paddles fore and aft, the Bessemer customarily performed the distance of 21 miles between Dover and Calais in 1 hour and 30 minutes. He would rather have been above decks now, facing into the wind, able then perhaps to imagine himself steaming toward some grander, more accessible goal. But the promenade of a swinging saloon offered no bulwark, only an iron railing, and the channel wind was damp and cold. And he had, he reminded himself, only the one goal now, and it, in all likelihood, a fool's errand. Still, Sybil Gerard. He had decided, upon reading the telegram to Egremont, against having her number spun. He had expected it might attract unwanted attention. With criminal anthropometry holding sway at Central Statistics, of course, he had been proven correct, and he rather suspected that Sybil Gerard's file might no longer exist.
Walter Gerard of Manchester, sworn enemy of progress, agitator for the rights of man, hanged. And if Walter Gerard had had a daughter, what might have become of her? And if she had been ruined, as she claimed to have been, by Charles Egremont? Oliphant's back began to ache. Beneath the chair's stiff brocade, jacquard woven with repeated images of the Bessemer, the horsehair stuffing held a chill. But if nothing else, he reminded himself, he at least had temporarily escaped the soft black pit of Dr. McNeil's patent Swiss bathtub. Putting his brandy aside unfinished, he nodded then and napped, and dreamed, perhaps, of the eye. The Bessemer docked at Calais at 1:30. Monsieur Lucien Arslau's apartments were in Passy. At noon, Oliphant presented his card to the concierge, who conveyed it via pneumatic tube to Monsieur Arslau's establishment. Almost immediately, the whistle attached to a nickeled speaking tube peeped twice. The concierge bent his ear to the funnel. Oliphant made out faint tones of shouted French. The concierge showed Oliphant to the lift. He was admitted, on the fifth floor, by a liveried manservant wearing an ornate Corsican stiletto through a pleated sash of Gros de Naples. The young man managed to bow without taking his eyes from Oliphant. Monsieur Arslau regretted, the servant said, that he was unable at the moment to receive Monsieur Oliphant. In the meantime, would Monsieur Oliphant care for any sort of refreshment? Oliphant declared that he would very much appreciate an opportunity to bathe. He would also find a pot of coffee most agreeable. He was led through a broad drawing room, rich in satin and ormolu, boule cabinets, bronzes, statuettes, and porcelain, where the lizard-eyed emperor and his dainty empress, the former Miss Howard, gazed from twin portraits in oil. And then through a morning room hung with proof engravings. A graceful curve of stairway mounted from an octagonal anteroom. Some 2 hours later, having bathed in a marble-rimmed tub of gratifying solidity, having taken strong French coffee and lunched upon cutlets à la maintenon, and wearing borrowed linen with far more starch than he cared for, he was ushered into the study of Monsieur Arslau. "Mr. Oliphant, sir," Arslau said in his excellent English, "it is a great pleasure. I regret not having been able to see you earlier, but..." He gestured toward a broad mahogany desk littered with files and papers. From behind a closed door came the steady clatter of a telegraph. On one wall hung a framed engraving of the great Napoleon, its mighty gear towers rising behind a gridwork of plate glass and iron. "Not at all, Lucien. I'm grateful to have had the time to take advantage of your hospitality. Your chef has an extraordinary way with mutton, a sublimated meat that could scarcely have grown on any mundane sheep." Arslau smiled. Nearly Oliphant's height, broader in the shoulders, he was some 40 years of age and wore his graying beard in the imperial fashion. His cravat was embroidered with small golden bees. "I've had your letter, of course." He returned to his desk and settled himself in a high-backed chair upholstered in dark green leather. Oliphant took a seat in an armchair opposite. "I must admit my curiosity, Lawrence, as to what it is you are currently about." Arslau made a steeple of his fingers and peered over them, raising his eyebrows. "The nature of your request would hardly seem to warrant the precautions you deem necessary." "On the contrary, Lucien. You must know that I would not presume in this way upon our acquaintance, for any but the most pressing of reasons." "But no, my friend," Arslau said with a dismissive little wave of his hands. "You have asked the merest of favors. Among colleagues, men such as ourselves, it is nothing. I am simply curious. It is one of my many vices. You convey to me a letter by imperial diplomatic pouch, no mean feat in itself for an Englishman, though I know that you are familiar with our friend Bayard. Your letter requires my help in locating a certain English adventuress, no more. You believe she may be resident in France, yet you stress the need for very great secrecy.
You warn me particularly against communicating with you either by telegraph or by the regular post. You instruct me to await your arrival. What am I to make of this? Have you succumbed at last to the wiles of some woman?
Alas, I have not.
Given the current model of English womanhood, my friend, I find that entirely understandable. Far too many of your gentlewomen aspire to be elevated to the level of masculine intellectuality, superior to crinoline, superior to pearl powder, above taking the pains to be pretty, above making themselves agreeable in any way. What a dreary, utilitarian, entirely ugly life an Englishman shall eventually lead if this trend continues. So why, then, I ask, have you crossed the Channel to find an English adventuress? Not that we haven't our share of them. They're rather thick upon the ground, actually, not to mention the origin, Arslau smiled, of our own Empress. You yourself have never married, Lucien, Oliphant remarked, attempting to deflect Arslau from his purpose. But look at matrimony. Who is to say which shall be the one judicious selection out of the 999 mistakes? Which is to be the one eel out of the barrel of snakes? The girl on the curbstone may be the one woman out of every female creature in this universe capable of making me a happy man, my friend. Yet I pass her by and bespatter her with the mud from my wheels in my utter ignorance. Arslau laughed. No, I have not married. And your mission is a political one.
Of course.
Things are not well with Britain. I don't need my British sources to tell me that, Oliphant. The papers suffice. The death of Byron. Great Britain's political direction, Lucien, indeed, her ultimate stability as a nation, may even now be at stake. I need not remind you of the paramount importance of our two nations' continued mutual recognition and support. And the matter of this Miss Gerard, Oliphant? Shall I take it you suggest she is somehow pivotal in the situation?
Oliphant took out his cigar case and selected one of Beeden's Habanas. His fingers brushed the folded text of Sybil Gerard's telegram. He closed the case.
Do you mind if I smoke?
Please do.
Thank you. The matters which hinge upon Sybil Gerard are entirely British. Entirely domestic. They may stand, ultimately, to affect France, but in a most indirect way. Oliphant clipped and pierced his cigar.
Are you entirely sure of that?
I am.
I am not.
Arslau rose to bring Oliphant a copper ashtray atop a walnut stand. He returned to his desk, but remained standing. What do you know of the Jacardine Society? They are the approximate equivalent of our Steam Intellect Society, are they not?
Yes and no. There is another, a secret society within the Jacardines. They style themselves Les Fils de Vaucanson. Certain of them are anarchists, others in league with the Marianne, others with the Universal Fraternity, others with any sort of rabble. Class war conspirators, you understand? Others are simply criminals. But you know this, Lawrence.
Oliphant took a lucifer from a box emblazoned with a stippled image of the Bessemer and struck it. He lit his cigar.
You tell me that the woman you know as Sybil Gerard is of no concern to France,
Arslau said.
You think otherwise?
Perhaps. Tell me what you know of our difficulties with the great Napoleon.
Very little.
Wakefield of Central Statistics mentioned it to me. The engine is no longer functioning accurately. Ordinateurs, thank the good God, are not my specialty. The Napoleon performs with its accustomed speed and accuracy in most instances, I am informed. But an outré element of inconstancy presently haunts the machine's higher functions. Arslau sighed. Those higher functions being deemed a matter of considerable national pride, I have myself been forced to peruse reams of the most abstruse technical prose in the Empire. To no ultimate avail, it now seems, as we've had the culprit in hand.
The culprit.
An avowed member of Les Fils de Vaucanson. His name is of no importance.
He was arrested in Lyon in connection with an ordinary case of civil fraud involving a municipal ordinateur. Elements of his subsequent confession brought him to the attention of the Commission of Special Services, and hence to ours. During interrogation, he revealed his responsibility for the current lamentable state of our great Napoleon.
He confessed to le sabotage, then?
No, he would not confess to that. He refused until the end. With regard to the Napoleon, he would admit only to having run a certain sequence of punch cards, a mathematical formula.
Oliphant watched the smoke from his cigar spiral toward the high ceiling's ornate plaster rosette.
The formula came from London, Arslau continued. He obtained it from an Englishwoman. Her name was Sybil Gerard.
Have you attempted analysis of this formula?
No. It was stolen, our Jacquardin claimed, spirited away by a woman he knew as Flora Bartel, apparently an American.
I see.
Then tell me what you see, my friend, for I myself am very much in the dark.
The eye, all-seeing, the sublime weight of its perception pressing in upon him from every direction.
Oliphant hesitated. Ash from his cigar fell unnoticed to Arslau's rich carpet.
I have yet to meet Sybil Gerard, he said, but I may be able to offer you information regarding this formula you've mentioned. It may even be possible to obtain a copy. I can promise nothing, however, until I myself am allowed to interview the lady in question, privately and at some length.
Arslau fell silent. He seemed to look through Oliphant. At last he nodded.
We can arrange that.
She is not, I take it, in custody?
Let us say that we are aware of her movements.
To allow her apparent freedom, yet observe her closely?
Precisely that. If we take her now, and she reveals nothing, the trail goes cold.
As ever, Arslau, your technique is impeccable. And when might it be arranged for me to meet with her?
The eye, the pressure, the pounding of his heart.
This evening, if you so desire, said Monsieur Arslau of the Police des Châteaux, adjusting his gold-embroidered cravat. The walls of the Café de l'Univers were hung with paintings, etched mirrors, and enamel plaques advertising the ubiquitous product of Pernod Fils. The pictures, if one could call them that, were either grotesque daubs, seemingly executed in a messy imitation of engine stippling, or clear geometric formulations, suggesting the restless motion of kinetrope bits. In some cases, Oliphant supposed, the painters themselves were present, or such he took them to be, these long-haired fellows in velvet caps, their corduroy trousers smeared with pigment and tobacco ash. But the majority of the clientele, according to his companion, one Jean Béraud, consisted of kinotropistes. These gentlemen of the Latin Quarter sat and drank with their black-clad grisette at the round marble tables, or held forth on theoretical matters before small groups of their peers. Béraud, in an unseasonable boater and a brown suit of intensely Gallic cut, was one of Arslau's mouchards, a professional informer who referred to the kinotropists as members of Le Milieu. He was fresh and rosy as a young pig. He drank vitel and peppermint, and Oliphant had taken an immediate dislike to him. End of side 10. To continue, change side selector switch and turn the cassette over.